Tonight on WNED PBS, Frontline will air the final segment of its two-part documentary, America's Great Divide, From Obama to Trump. The series focuses on the nation's increasingly bitter, divided, and toxic politics. It's a familiar theme for UB's distinguished professor of political science, Dr. James Campbell. In 2016, he addressed the topic at the beginning of the Trump presidency with his book, Polarized, Making Sense of a Divided America.
Dr. Campbell, thanks for coming in and joining us.
Glad to be here.
You know, when I was doing my research here, I came across a piece that ended up in the L.A. Times under your byline, and I'll just kind of read it. It just said, talking about a contentious presidential campaign, and it said, quote, whoever survives this cage match election should not expect a honeymoon period come January. We should point out that although that might be applicable right now, you wrote that in 2016.
Yes, yes.
And it turned out to be prophetic.
Yeah, well, we've been having very, very polarized elections now for some time, but they're getting more so. And we know that the American public has become more polarized. And events, it's partly events and it's partly the parties now that the people have chosen up sides. And it gets more and more that way.
You may or may not have predicted it, but when you kind of look back through your mind's eye here and how this polarization has been coming, is this impeachment any surprise?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, certainly the incentives are there for impeachment, but practically speaking, you know, both sides want to reach out to the center as well as satisfy their base. And I think that's why Speaker Pelosi was at least initially reluctant to pursue this. And I think, you know, she was to some extent pulled into it. Both by events, but also by a need to keep her base happy, and I think that's all part of this. But parties have always been torn between satisfying their ideological bases, but they aren't sufficient to win an election. So you have to also reach out to the center. Now, the center has become less important, and the bases have become more important as the public has polarized. And so now Democrats depend more heavily on liberals and Republicans depend more heavily on conservatives than they used to. And so they are less inclined to moderate their positions.
And though that's become kind of the anecdotal description of the modern era, right. You actually you've mined surveys over the years that really show that this has been in the works for some time.
Yes, I went back and I looked at ideological self-identification as measured by a number of major survey organizations over time since the late 1960s, early 70s. And we've seen, you know, back then the public was fairly polarized. It was about 50-50. So you could say the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. And now it's more like a 60-40 nation. That is, 60% of the nation is ideological, either liberal or conservative, and 40% is moderate. So when people like to say that Americans are very moderate, that the moderates are a plurality, but they are no longer a majority of Americans. And that becomes even more so when you look at voters, because the bases are more likely to turn out to vote. And a lot of moderates are more likely to be torn and less likely to show up at the polls.
So we have that reality. What's the cause?
Well, actually, I think polarization in American politics is more natural than unpolarized politics. I think there has been a change, but I think what the condition of American politics back in the 1940s and 50s and early 60s was more unusual, and I think there were really two reasons for that. One is there was a generational reason, that the generation that dominated the electorate at that point had survived the Great Depression, a great galvanizing event that, you know, put other differences in perspective, and also World War II. I think both of those, the Depression and World War II, were factors that made that generation, the so-called greatest generation, less polarized. On top of that, a second reason is the parties. Really, the parties after the Civil War, so this goes way back, were more heterogeneous. You know, there was a study back in the 1950s, early 50s, by the American Political Science Association called Toward a More Responsible Party System. The complaint back then was that the parties were too muddled, that they were too moderate. They didn't present a clear choice to voters. And a lot of that goes back to the fact that there was no Republican Party in the South, no serious Republican Party in the South after the Civil War up until the 1980s and 90s. So you had a Democratic Party that was really had two large wings, a non-Southern, more liberal wing of the party, and then a Southern conservative wing. That meant the party was, on balance, total everything up, was a fairly moderate party. But it was moderate because it had two strong wings. And that muddled differences. There was no natural home for conservatives, no natural home for liberals. And that changed when in the 1960s. That began the change. Really, the public changed first. The parties came along later. And so we had this period that the political scientists called de-alignment, and we had greater split-ticket voting and lower voter turnout. I think all of those things were signs that the American public did not feel as well represented by the parties, by the sort of newly polarized electorate was not being well represented by the less polarized parties.
That brings up, I think, a key question to this then. Do we point the finger toward the party leaders, or is the for polarization? Or what do you think?
No, I think they're responding to where the votes are. I mean, you have a much larger body of the electorate who are call themselves conservatives, and a fairly large group that call themselves liberals, and they want to be represented by political leaders that reflect their views, and so. I think people have this sense that a lot of American politics is top down. I think it's much more bottom up than a lot of people want to admit. The leaders are leading with air quotes around them.
Right.
They're trying to anticipate what will get supported, what will win support out there in the public, and what won't.
What about the role of major institutions inside this whole element of polarization, the media?
Well, I think this is where things get more heated probably than they need to, because I think a lot of the major institutions now don't reflect the polarization in the public. So the media tends to be more liberal, educators tend to be more liberal. Scientists, I mean, there are a lot of surveys now on this that indicate that these mediating institutions are representing one side of the spectrum but not the other. And I think that's why a lot of trust has been lost by, you know, more moderates and conservatives in a lot of these mediating institutions. And that actually, I think, inflames polarization. I mean, it makes it more possible for us not to have buy into the same set of facts and to distrust authority. You know, when somebody says, well, why don't some people believe in climate change, or why don't they believe in, vaccinations? I mean, I think the authorities are no longer trusted as much. And to some extent, maybe they aren't doing as good a job as they should. I mean, I think in education, you know, we depend on peer review. Well, that breaks down if you don't have a real competition of perspectives. You know, you can't just have one side slapping each other on the back and saying, oh, you've done a great job, and the other side saying, well, I don't believe anything they have to say. Then the whole system collapses. And so I think we need a competition of perspectives. You know, the parties have a lot of reasons to listen to what people are saying. Outside of that, that's kind of blunted. And you don't have that same strong incentive for everybody to try to represent the views that are out there.
Interesting how we're kind of talking about how conservatives have found their way into the Republican Party and liberals. I mean, I guess they always were to a certain extent, but it's become more entrenched. There's no real liberal wing necessarily of the Republican Party. There's not really a conservative wing of the Democratic Party.
Right.
But I'm interested in how you view President Trump, because I would think that somebody who we would have labeled as a conservative 20 years ago, just those values, that type of person, what was important to them, are they really being reflected in the person who is in the White House right now?
I think so. I think they think they're being represented well by him. And I think, you know, a lot of conservatives became some very notable conservatives, George Will and others, Bill Kristol, became never Trumpers. And I mean, there's a lot about Trump that deviated from conservative orthodoxy, and certainly in style. So the other side of that coin is that I think a lot of conservatives saw in Trump and continue to see in Trump somebody who's more of a fighter for them. And I first sort of noticed this during the Republican presidential nomination debates back in 2016. When, you know, we went one after another, one round of debates after another. And when issues would come up, Trump would always refer to his ability to win, his standing in the polls. So, you know, he's got 25 points in the polls and this other guy has 2 points or whatever. And it was always about winning. And I thought, well, this is a very vacuous response. There's
right.
no substance here. But I thought, well, that's what people want. They're tired. And there's actually some interesting survey evidence about this. Republicans at that point, conservatives at that point, thought they were too often on the losing side. Even when they won elections, they wouldn't get policy changes that they wanted. There was a very good, very interesting Pew Research Center poll that asked conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats, do you think you're usually on the winning side or the losing side when it comes to major policy battles? This is back in 2015, 2016. Liberal Democrats were about evenly divided in that. You know, everybody thinks they're, you know, whether you're a Patriots fan or a Bills fan, you usually think the calls are going against you. Right? You know, so that's
I'm
that's,
a Bills
that's,
fan. That's, I can yeah, tell you yeah, the calls right, are always going against
right,
us.
Right. So, you know, that's kind of natural. But on the conservative Republican side, something like 83%, 82%, I forget the exact number, but over 80% thought they were usually on the losing side. And so I think this is one aspect of polarization I think is very interesting. Because of polarized politics and people talking to like-minded people and thinking that their views are more popular than perhaps they really are, they get really teed off when they lose. So it's that sort of that was a good friend of mine, Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein wrote a book called It's Even Worse Than It Looks. And they blamed a lot of polarization in Congress on the Tea Party conservatives. And my response to that was that both sides have their extremists. Both sides have people who are upset. But when you're on the losing side, that gets activated.
And we most certainly seen that from Democrats since 2016.
Exactly. So now Democrats, yeah, I think the whole impeachment thing is a way to kind of mollify, in a sense, to show for the leadership to show that they are being represented, the more extreme views in the party are being represented by the leaders. You know, when Republicans didn't do that, you know, a lot of their leaders lost and were thrown. John Boehner, you know, ask John Boehner about it. He's gone. You know? So if you try, you know, and Paul Ryan. So I think that's part of this the conflict that goes on here. Because if you're on the losing side in these highly polarized times, that really gets people motivated, because they all think, both sides think, that they're more dominant. You know, liberals talk to other liberals, and you know and then there's a confirmation bias and all of that. People build up the idea that their side is should be, you know, if justice prevailed, they should be ruling.
Right.
And if it's not, well, somebody stole the election, somebody rigged the election, somebody, and so we got to tip over the table, or we're going to impeach you, or or whatever. And I think that's part of this conflict. And I think, unfortunately, it feeds on itself, and things are going to get worse before they get better, I'm afraid, because I don't think there aren't cool heads in the game here.
That brings me to not the final question, but I think kind of a big part of this is, so when it comes to polarization, is there a remedy and do we need a remedy?
Well, I don't think there's a remedy because it is ingrained in people's views. I think so there's no remedy to polarization. But I think there are perhaps remedies to the dysfunctional aspects of polarization, and that is the lack of civility, the sort of unwillingness to compromise with the other side. And I think we have to work on, I think, sort of creating a new civics in our educational system, in our broadcasting, and that emphasizes discussion across sides that doesn't demonize each other, and actually encourages people to see the other side and talk to the other side, to talk about politics.
Right.
Now, half the time you start talking about politics, people go, oh, we can't talk about that.
You still talk about politics?
I talk about politics all the time, but I love a fight. I talk about politics in academia, so I've got very few people on my side.
Right.
But I think that's people have to, what's the proper way to talk about politics? We don't have to make things ad hominem. Talk about ideas. That's what we should all be talking about, and how to get to some kind of, some kind of common ground. I mean, I'm not going to convince liberals to be a conservative or a conservative to be a liberal, but we can talk about those issues and why we think as we do about it, and maybe see the other side. And if we see the other side, maybe we can find a way to work things out.
The Democrats, of course, are going through – they're not even in the primaries yet, but they're going through the debates. They're heading into the primaries. And what would be your advice for a candidate who wants to win that party and challenge President Trump?
Well, I think first you have to win the nomination. And I think to win the nomination, you have to – convince Democratic primary goers and caucus goers that you represent them, that you represent their fairly liberal views, but also that you can win the election. And so that's the trick here. And I'm not sure they have anyone in the race at this point. I think some people think Biden is the guy who has the magic mix. I think he's got some other problems, but he is the king of gaffes, and I'm not sure. He's got some baggage with him that came along with this impeachment efforts, actually, and I think that may be part of it. Mayor Pete, I think, is a possibility, but he's got some problems too, I think, as a general election candidate. So I'm not sure who there's. It's going to be interesting. If I had to bet at this point, I would bet Elizabeth Warren will be their candidate, be the Democratic candidate, partly because, she's a smart person, and I think she reflects those pretty liberal views of Democrats, so she digs into kind of the Sanders constituency some. Whether she, parties tend to, this is another part of polarization, I think, parties tend to see their candidates and, within the party, candidate supporters tend to see their candidates as being more electable than maybe an objective observer would be. You're looking at the 2016 exit polls, for instance, during the Republican primaries. I was surprised to see how often Donald Trump was seen as the most electable Republican candidate, even though the prevailing wisdom among those of us who look at polls and try to figure out these elections was that he was probably the least electable. So that electability issue may not come into play as much as it should be because people are, you know, engaged in wishful thinking about their candidate. Right. Of course, sometimes it's true, you know. But the other aspect of this is we are so polarized that individual candidate characteristics that are liabilities will be, often be overlooked by partisans. I mean, I think, you know, we spent 2.5 years in the Mueller investigation looking at what happened with the Russian meddling and all this. And I think, if, you know, from my standpoint, I thought I saw what happened when the exit polls came out. We saw Hillary Clinton's unfavorable numbers in the polls and then also in the exit poll in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. They were pretty constant. Well, what happened was Trump's unfavorables declined. Now, this has nothing to do with WikiLeaks or anything else. What it was is Republicans coming home. And Republicans rationalizing to themselves. Republicans who had thought Trump was unacceptable. I'll never vote for Trump. At the end of the day, a lot of them came home and they were reluctant Trump supporters or voters and thought to themselves, well, maybe he's not so bad. And I think that's what, you know, people try to resolve.
And based on polls now, they think he's excellent. It's, I mean, the Republican support now for him is, I mean, the favorability ratings are unbelievable.
Yeah, they're very good.
Among Republicans.
Among Republicans, right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, we have this polarization period here that people are willing to, you know, if Trump were not the president and they had a lot of the background information that they had in 2016, I think they'd still say he was unfavorable, that they'd be unfavorable about him. But, you know, they have that experience with him now. They're used to him a little bit, and they see the policy consequences. And for those reasons, I think they're willing to look past some of the more colorful aspects of his leadership style.
So. Very good. Dr. James Campbell, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.